Such a pleasure to welcome back to Value Conferences, Chris Rosbach, Managing Partner at J. Stern & Co. in London. J. Stern is a London-based family office established to provide investments for the Stern family. It is devoted to long-term investments for families with a multi-generational approach. The firm builds on the Stern family's 200-year-old banking tradition with a conservative approach and institutional-level analysis and resources. The firm does manage bespoke concentrated global equities portfolios following a strict value approach and based on proprietary analysis and with a long-term investment horizon. Prior to co-founding the firm, Chris had senior investment roles at Merian Capital, Magnetar, Lansdowne Partners, and Perry Capital. Chris holds a BA from Yale and an MBA from Harvard. It's always a pleasure to welcome you back to this forum, Chris. We look forward to the idea you will share with us today. I'm going to be back with a brief Q&A session following your remarks, but mostly I'll encourage the participants to follow up with any questions. And with that, Chris, I'd like to turn it over to you for your remarks. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you very much, John. It's a pleasure to be participating in the conference. I've done that over the past couple of years, and I've greatly enjoyed the experience and the exchange both with yourself and with the participants. So thank you for the opportunity. In past years, we've discussed a number of European stocks. We've talked about MTU, the German aerospace company that makes engine components, and that had a slow start after I talked about it, but that since then has done quite well. And last year, we talked about Dignity, which is the UK funeral services company that has gone from strength to strength and has continued to perform even despite the volatility that came from Brexit. So this year, I want to talk about a company that has been a core holding of ours for many, many years. I've first bought it over 10 years ago when I was working at another fund and have had the position in the different funds and investment businesses that I've been involved in. It's Sika. Sika is a Swiss company. It has a market cap of just over 10 billion Swiss francs. It is a global leader in what it does. It is not an obviously cheap company, but it has tremendous value and the potential for creating a value for its shareholders over a long period of time. And for that reason, it's a core position and that I want to talk about and suggest that you all take a hard look at as a potential investment. So Sika is a global leader in sealing, bonding, reinforcing, and protecting concrete structures, as well as in using similar materials for other applications, in particular in industrial and automotive uses. 79% of the sales come from the construction division. Another 21% of sales come from the industrial division, a substantial portion of that from automotive. What Sika does, and you can see the pictures there in the slide that I've put together, is they make additives and sealants that help concrete to set and to be structural, as well as products that help to waterproof and insulate buildings in its core. And the picture on the bottom left is one of the first things that Sika did, which was the construction of the Gotthard Tunnel in Switzerland when it went from steam to electric, and therefore it became important to waterproof it. It was Sika who provided the coatings materials that were used at the time. And the second picture is the new Gotthard Tunnel, where Sika is still at it with the yellow foils that you see there. The basic point about the company, and we will be coming back to that, is that it has achieved an integrated portfolio and a technology leadership position in a niche that the big cement companies and the big construction companies and construction components companies have essentially gotten out of. It has significant competitors in the form of Henkel, W. R. Grace, or Dow in various of its products. But in terms of an integrated solution, it is an absolute leader at what it does, which is an important thing, as I'm going to try to argue. But very importantly, what it does compared to the overall value that it creates and the risk that occurs if one of its components fails is very modest, and as a result, it has very significant pricing power and is able to generate margins that are far higher than really any of the industries that it is a supplier to. So that's a key question as we look for companies that have competitive advantage and that can generate value over time. That's a very important consideration for us. So if you look at the business, then it is very widely geographically spread. EMEA is about 47%. The rest is across the world. And importantly, it operates, it has about 170 factories that it has built. So it has dramatically increased its geographic footprint and has put in place over the last 10 years really a network with which to leverage the global growth that comes from that. If you look at it further, the business is really driven by what we've called here the mega trends that you see. So it's urbanization in terms of the construction business, which means a concrete, complex, high-level construction, and the type of infrastructure that goes with that in terms of roads, tunnels, bridges, airports, and so forth, all of which require vast amounts of concrete. And then on the automotive side, new vehicle design, which is a question of cars becoming lighter, having more plastics and sophisticated materials, and those materials being glued and bonded rather than welded or otherwise attached as they were in the past. So these are very big movements that Sika participates in, and its technology is at the cutting edge of implementing this change that we're seeing. If you look at the basic investment thesis then that I've alluded to, is that it has this strong position in its fields, and as a result of that, we think that it can grow its sales at 5 to 10% a year over the long term. And very importantly, in this 80% of the business roughly that is construction related, 80% of that is related to refurbishment. So if you think of the infrastructure that's been put in place in Europe and the United States, that is in general old. Construction and concrete construction is in general old. So while you would look at this and say, what is the long-term growth potential of residential and non-residential construction in our markets here, you'd say, well, that's not that dramatic, but the potential for refurbishment is obviously significant. And that's a very important issue. And we'll come back to that, because the issue is not just the case with the infrastructure and the construction we have here in Europe and the US, but it is also in emerging markets, and in particular in China, where we're also nearing 2 to 3 decades from the construction boom, and therefore we're getting to the point where there's a significant need for refurbishment, and construction in general has not been done to the same levels as it is here. It's interesting to note that Sika's share price has gone from 800 Swiss francs to 4,200 Swiss francs, and actually now even higher than that, closer to 4,800 since the early 2000s. So it's a sense of seeing what the tremendous value is that a business like that can generate, and we think that it has the potential to do that going forward. And a very important issue that I'm also going to touch on is that the company is subject to a hostile takeover by a French construction company, Saint-Gobain, which has sought to buy the super voting shares of the founding family for a significant premium. Shareholders, the board, and management are resisting this. We are expecting an outcome of an initial litigation in October. We have been fairly significantly involved in trying to represent and protect shareholders' rights. We think that in either outcome there is value, but it clearly is a situation that people will have to be aware of. And so as you all are looking at this as a potential investment in a high-class company, this is something that you will need to take into account. If you look at the key statistics, as I said, The market cap is now at 12 billion Swiss francs. It has no debt. It is trading at its highs, and it is trading at a valuation in PE terms of around 20 times. It's growing around 10%, so you can see that reflected in these numbers. We think it can do that for a long time. That is not an obviously cheap valuation, but we think that from the perspective of a Philip Fisher type investment, of a company that has competitive advantage and can generate value over time, it's a compelling stock, even if it fails some of the Benjamin Graham valuation kind of criteria. The share price has increased significantly, as we said, and has done so despite recently the corporate situation that it's been under, which is an interesting thing. It seems like in addition to the core shareholders, which are in particular Cascade, the family office of Bill and Melinda Gates, and the investment manager for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Trust, and other large institutional shareholders, it seems that other people have been buying as well in anticipation of, I think, both the value in the company, but also a positive resolution of the shareholder issue. I have to say we're somewhat surprised with just how strong the share price development is, but clearly if it hadn't performed as it did, given how strong the earnings have been, the multiple would have been lower, and so it may well be a question of value prevailing even over the corporate risk that comes from the takeover situation. If you look at it, the one relative value graph that we will look at is the long-term PE ratio that a company will trade on, and you can see given the strong growth that it's had, it actually has traded along the lines and in a range of these multiples. During the financial crisis, it traded down from the roughly 18 to 20 times level to an extraordinary bargain opportunity. It has that in common with many stocks, and those that had the opportunity to buy at those valuations have clearly done very well. If you recall in particular the share price chart of that I showed you before. But you can see that even though for the type of company you might say that the multiple is elevated, it is still very much within a range. And I just want to highlight that as part of this ongoing discussion of whether valuations are high. I think they are clearly 10 to 20% higher than we would like them to be, and then in this instance the average has been. But if we're looking at a company that can generate the type of growth and the type of returns that Sika has, then clearly we're looking at 1 or 2 years of returns. If the multiple were to decline again because of some kind of market circumstance or other reason, and as part of our core long-term investment philosophy here, we believe that it's exactly those kinds of companies that we want to invest in, and because we have a 5 to 10 year investment horizon or longer, we like Philip Fisher, like Warren Buffett in one of his most famous quotes, and my favorite one, where he says it's better to buy a great company at a good price than a good company at a great price. We think this applies to Sika on this. I'll touch on some of the key issues in the business. They've announced a strategic plan for 2018 that they outlined in 2012. They've essentially achieved a very substantial portion of it in terms of the organic growth that they're trying to have, in terms of taking the EBIT margins from 8.6 to 12.6%, in terms of opening new plants, which is a key aspect of the business, because one of the keys is that both the additives and the products that they create are not actually difficult to produce. They are difficult to transport, and it's not worth the transport, but the expertise comes from the technology and from the long track record in terms of the reliability of the product. And so the strategy that Sika has had is to open these significant new plants that they have, to ramp those up, and to have a strong competitive position as a result. They've done that over the last 10 years, as I said, in particular as a result of this aggressive strategic plan, and they're now at the point where they can generate the operating leverage from those plants as the capacity. So that's really the key in terms of the outline. If we touch just a bit more in detail on the two different businesses, construction, which is the largest one, and then industrial and automotive, again, the key is, as I said, that they have a comprehensive product line that they can use to address the needs of residential and non-residential construction. There's examples here in this, both instances actually, of construction projects in the developed world, one in England, one in Norway, one a shopping center, one a tunnel that needs to be built. And the point is that they have various points of attack when these kinds of construction projects are built. They have close relationships and sell directly through the key project designers because they have the suite of products, and that allows them to compete in a completely different basis than a company that just produces cement additives, for example, or some kind of foil or other construction component. They are providing solutions that help to achieve the goals that you need to. And if you look at the drivers, I've mentioned it, it's new construction and refurbishment. As you basically look through the opportunity set in the different markets, I think that we're looking at a slow but steady situation in Germany and the rest of continental Europe, a situation that doesn't look so different in the UK, and a situation that is also slow but improving in the United States in terms of the new construction. The refurbishment is obviously somewhat countercyclical. In other words, when you don't build new buildings or tear down buildings to build new ones, you refurbish. And as I said, 80% of the business is in refurbishment, so Sika very much benefits from that, as well as from some of the other big issues, which is the increased need simply in performance, as well as the increased need for safety and environmental compliance from a regulatory perspective. So all of these things mean that the people who procure the types of products that Sika sells have a great incentive to go for a company that has a long track record of performance, as opposed to looking for someone who might be price competitive in order to save on the margin of a construction project, but that then would be impacted by performance issues. And we're going to touch on that on the next page that I've highlighted, because this is not just true for Europe and the United States, but it is in particular true for China, where there's been a dramatic increase in construction over the last 20 and 30 years. The bubble chart that you see on the next page, actually, John, page 12, is the size of the non-residential, of the construction, excuse me, of the concrete repair market in China, which is expected to grow very substantially and is going to be along the line, is going to be a multi-billion-dollar market growing from the level that it's at. The image is a city in China that I've been at, Lanzhou, China. The first picture is from the early 1900s. The second picture is not one I took, but it's a recent picture. All of these concrete buildings that have been built are in need of refurbishment, and whether it's leaking roofs, whether it's cracking cement, whether it's corroding steel reinforcements in the cement, these are all issues that need to be addressed, and Sika has a comprehensive product range. So if you look at a city like Lanzhou, which when I was there had 9 million people, the revenue opportunity for Sika essentially in any of these 20 roughly story concrete buildings is in the order of 3 to 5 million Swiss francs. And so they don't need to get to anything like 100% market share of this market, nor does all of this need to be done in the near future in order to see that the market potential that they have is very significant, and they've put in the infrastructure, the network of both plants and distributors, and very importantly, the experts who can deal with the people who are managing these projects, in order to address this market. And again, they have competitors, of course. Some of them would presumably also like to acquire them if there was the opportunity after the resolution of the current issue. But they don't have the full they don't have the full breadth of the products, and therefore they cannot be partners in the solution. So the opportunity is very significant, and I think a very important driver going forward. Then to turn just briefly to the automotive division, it's about 430 million Swiss francs of sales and has also grown extremely strongly. That has to do with some of the trends that are taking place. It's in particular to lighter weight and more sophisticated components in cars, and a greater component of carbon and other types of lightweight materials. And as I said, they're no longer welded or attached with bolts. That was the word I was looking for earlier, but rather they are bonded and sealed and glued. So if you think of a car, and in particular if you have a German one, you might be familiar. Sika has the sealants around the windows. You will recognize perhaps that little triangle. But the business grows much further than that in terms of sealants that glue windshields onto cars, that glue bumpers, that provide insulation, dampening, and even structural rigidity, all of which is related to the same kind of technology of bonding and of sealing that they also use on the construction side. And related to that as well is if you think of high-rise buildings, the glass components and windows to those are also no longer screwed or attached with some kind of a system, but in many cases, again, they're glued onto those buildings. And the high-performance glue that has to withstand the wind and other impacts and vibrations comes from Sika. Likewise, if you think of trains, the high-speed trains that we have in Europe, the windshields and the windows are not attached, they're glued. And again, those are the adhesives that Sika has made. So these are the qualitative reasons for the growth that they have. They're very important to us because it's that kind of business and competitive advantage that will drive the performance going forward. But it's important to understand if we're going to look at not an undervalued company that is coming out of some kind of a cyclical downturn or some kind of distress, but that is rather going from strength to strength. The reason why that is the case and why there's the prospect for that to continue is obviously the key to the investment thesis. That takes us to the issue that the company is facing, which is the hostile takeover attempt by Saint-Gobain. Now, we have been working alongside some of the other large shareholders to resist this. We are not activists. We don't seek to change what companies do. We try to invest in those companies that we think have a strong competitive position and where management is working in our interests, and we will sell and take our money elsewhere if we find that managements aren't following what they've said that they would do and what we think they should. In the case of Sika, the opposite is the case. The board and the management are entirely aligned with shareholders. There was a generational change in the family, and the heirs to the founding Burkhard Schenker Winkler family got an offer to sell their 16% economic shareholding, which came with 52% of votes because of a registration provision that was put in place at the IPO of the company, to Saint-Gobain, the French construction conglomerate, for a very substantial premium, about an 80% premium to the then share price, which is still something like a 30 to 40% premium to the current share price. The family effectively looked to take advantage of this voting right situation that they had. The argument from their side was, well, you should have known that these two share classes exist, and therefore caveat emptor. The truth, of course, is we did know, we did review the statutes, and the founding family, particular, the actual founder of the business in its current shape, who took it public, Mr. Burkhardt, the father of the current generation, put in place statutes that protected shareholders and an independent board. So looking at the statutes, you find that the registered shares that allow for this super voting right are registered only at the discretion of the board in the interest of the entire company and its stakeholders. So that is the test that is applied by the board, and the board of the company has always been very substantially independent and not family tied. So from our perspective, that was one of the key reasons in terms of the corporate governance that we felt comfortable investing in this extraordinary business. It is specifically what the family has been trying to circumvent in the sale that they've undertaken, that we are very confident in the legal position that has been taken by the board and by the management to say that the statutes are the statutes, the registration is at the discretion of the board, and the board does not see how handing control of the company to an acquirer who is bidding for 16% of the shares and not extending that bid to other shareholders could possibly be in the interest of anyone else other than the selling shareholders, the family, and the acquirer. So a decision, a first decision, is expected in October of this year, so in just a couple of weeks, although that is entirely up to the courts in Zug, and the resolution is going to likely take another 2 to 3 years from now. I've said earlier, it is frankly striking how well the share price has performed. It's a function of the strength of the business, I think, for the most part, in the face of this situation that has taken place. But I think both the actual legal situation has become clearer, at least in terms of the analysis, and the media coverage that has been taking place in Switzerland and elsewhere has become more understanding of the very simple legal argument that is at place here. I think it is somewhat of a test case for Switzerland in terms of its corporate governance in a environment that where the competitiveness and openness of financial systems is a very important aspect of the overall economic performance of countries and where people choose to do business, to invest, and to locate themselves. Between the legal situation and these other factors, I think there is a good chance that the court will decide in the right direction. If it does not, there are still very significant shareholder protections that are in place, in particular a provision under Swiss law whereby the majority of capital, so not of votes, can appoint a committee of experts that it can fund through a shareholder vote. And whose purpose is to assess the actions taken by the board and the management and to ensure that they are not to the detriment of majority shareholder, of the majority of the capital of shareholders. This committee has been put in place. The strategy of Saint-Gobain requires them to take over the company and to achieve significant synergies from integrating the business across the board, but in particular the very high growth mortar business, which is one of the aspects of the construction business that competes directly with Saint-Gobain and is frankly claiming a very significant market share from Saint-Gobain. So it's understandable from Saint-Gobain's perspective why they would want to make a defensive acquisition. This integration of the business and the creation and the allocation of synergies is something that will have to be watched very carefully. It is not credible that the owner of 16% of the capital would allow 84% of the value of those synergies to accrue to another business. It's a highlight of why it's an abusive situation. But if for whatever reason on the legal argument were to be lost over time and the other measures that might be taken do not prevail, then I think from a shareholder's perspective, the committee of experts will at the very least have a significant role in terms of protecting the interests and making sure that they accrue to all shareholders in proportion and not to the controlling voting shareholder. I don't expect that to take place, but it is a scenario, but it's one that I'm basically comfortable with as a long-term shareholder. Because I think that the value, the growth and the value that the company will generate over time will prevail even in that kind of an adverse outcome. The reason why I'm saying that is, one, because of the heavy involvement that we've had in terms of being involved at the shareholders' meeting, as well as in terms of trying to help shape public opinion, but because as each of you look at this investment, it is something that you will have to take into account, and in particular if the first decisions come in October of this year, you will have to assess whether you think that what the impact of those decisions will be, and if they go one way or another, how they will impact the value and the investment proposition that I'm talking about. We're comfortable with it, but everybody has to have their own assessment of that. So, in summary, I would just say that it's a compelling investment opportunity. It is a brilliant business that has the quality and the value that we look for in our long-term investment. It's a global leader. It has a management and a board that have an outstanding record of value creation over time. It has the type of competitive advantage we're looking for because of its own investment, because of the markets, because of the other factors I've talked about. It has the scope to significantly increase its revenues and its earnings. We think that the company can double over the next 5 to 10 years. We think the same will happen to the value of the company. It will benefit, I think, from the different trends that are taking place. I think, in particular, the increased need for investment and refurbishment in terms of infrastructure that I think is taking place in Europe and the United States, part because of the refugees and part because of the need for fiscal stimulus for the economy that I expect either administration in the U.S. Will start to implement. They have tailwinds. I've talked about the tailwinds from the refurbishment in China, and even though, as I've said, the valuation of the company is not as cheap as deep Benjamin Graham type value investors would like, I think from a Philip Fisher perspective of compounding returns over the long term, it is an extremely compelling opportunity that is tempered by the hostile takeover situation that it is in, but that, at least from our perspective, means it is an attractive investment and may have opportunities, depending on how some of the near-term decisions take place. So I think I'll leave it at that. I'm very happy to answer any questions that you have, John, for now, and I'm also very happy to engage with and answer questions that any of you might have as you look at this and as you think about it and hopefully do some work and make up your minds as to what you think. John.
Terrific. Thank you so much, Chris, for the presentation. Clearly, a company you know extremely well, and always nice to see shareholders actively fighting, if I may say, for their rights. A question perhaps just on those takeover dynamics. Is there a scenario where Saint-Gobain may actually extend the offer to the other shareholders? Would they have the resources to do so, or is that off the table?
I think that's an excellent question, because I think the question of what Saint-Gobain is doing in this situation is a very important one, because they effectively, the family was clearly looking to get a very high price for the shares that they have, and I think it's not unlikely that they went to talk to other industrial companies and financial investors who would normally look at this kind of business. And I think that from a strategic perspective, a number of the competitors would look very carefully at Sika if they thought that there was a transaction that could be done with the support of the company, the board, and the management, and obviously at a price that's acceptable. The fact that Saint-Gobain was the only one who engaged in this, I think, raises significant corporate governance issues for Saint-Gobain, because it is an abuse of shareholders, and I think it is something that is no longer acceptable, frankly, in 2016, after the decades of emphasis on accountability and on equal treatment and fair treatment of shareholders, to have a company so brazenly take advantage of one of the very last situations of unequal voting rights in a situation where the statutes likely invalidate that anyway, I think is really extraordinary. One of the reasons why they're doing it is because they themselves are very significantly capital constrained. Their market cap is, while it's larger, it is not that much larger than Sika's. And so I don't think that they're in a position to be able to extend the offer to shareholders. The offer that was made to the family was an 80% premium to a share price of about 3,800 Swiss francs. But even if you take into account the significant in the valuation since then, you would still be looking at a 30 to 50% premium to the current price, which would get you to a market cap of 15 to 20 billion Swiss francs, which is, I think, more than half the market cap of Saint-Gobain. So it is inconceivable, I think, that Saint-Gobain would be in a position to do that. They don't have the debt capacity to do so, and I don't think that they have the ability to dilute themselves from a shareholder's perspective either. In addition to which, Saint-Gobain has an absolutely appalling track record in terms of value generation. So if you kind of went back to that share price chart that I showed you, where when I first looked at this, the shares had gone from 400 to 800 Swiss francs, and I had a very significant argument about whether we had missed the opportunity. It actually goes further back than the share price chart to 2002, 2003, when I started getting involved. It's now at almost 5,000. If we laid over this, the share price chart of Saint-Gobain, it would be flat. So Saint-Gobain has generated no value in a time when Sika's shares have increased tenfold over a 10 to 12-year period. So I think there is no scenario in which it could be debt financed, and I think there is no scenario in which it could be equity financed, and I think there is no scenario in which the shareholders of Sika would be willing to accept Saint-Gobain shares in exchange for their Sika shares. So unfortunately, I don't think that that's a solution. I think there ought to be, and I've called for this both at the annual meeting and in other public venues, for Saint-Gobain to be reasonable, to realize that this is a transaction that they will never consummate, that if they do consummate it for legal reasons, they will have significant issues with the committee of experts. In other words, they will have paid a significant amount of money and an 80% premium for a 16% stake in a company that they will never control. Never control. And I think that that is an unreasonable situation. I think there are compromises that are possible in terms of stakes or asset swaps or similar types of agreements, and that I think the board and the management are likely to be open to if there was a constructive situation. But for now, I think it is frankly an impossible situation, and anyone who is both involved with or perhaps even among the participants who looks at Saint-Gobain as a potential investment, it fulfills a lot of value criteria. It is cheap. There are value investors who look at that as an attractive investment. I would just caution that a company that makes those kinds of decisions is not one that I think is an attractive business or is well run. And I think the share price performance of Saint-Gobain over the same period is as clear an indictment as you could possibly have.
And how do these dynamics affect your views of the controlling family at the company? You know, given that they're involved in this, does that make you worry about, even if this doesn't happen, that they may look for other ways to disadvantage minority shareholders?
I think that's also a very important question. We usually like to invest in companies where there are controlling shareholders, as long as the interests of those controlling shareholders, whether it's founders or families, are aligned with shareholders. And I think if you look at the one of the previous slides, I've included a screenshot of an op-ed that I published in the Financial Times where I talked about just that. I drew a parallel between the super voting rights at the big American tech companies, in particular Google, and Sika, where in the case of Google, there is a founder who, well, founders who intend to keep on controlling their shares and the company, but who've put into the relevant agreements that the value will be the same, and that if the shares are transferred, they will give up their voting rights so that the value is shared equally among shareholders. I think that's a really important principle. The question here is if the situation, if the courts decide that the family has been, is wrong, that it's at the discretion of the board to register these shares, I think that this will open the door to a discussion with the family to say, well, if their interest is to divest themselves of their stake because for whatever very important reasons they have, they want to no longer have the essentially their entire wealth, which is substantial, tied up in the company. Again, I would highlight that that 16% of Sika at one point was worth a couple of hundred million Swiss francs. At this point, it's worth something like 1.8 billion. So it is a very substantial increase that they have enjoyed as shareholders of this company. It is absolutely in their right to dispose of that if they will. I think both the company, the board, the management, and shareholders would be open to a solution where the family divests itself and where it receives some kind of consideration for the supervoting rights that they have, but it would need to be as part of an agreement that would resolve the situation. The Swiss law is very clear that, again, the registration has to take place in the interests of the entire company. And if the family were to, if shareholders, well, the board, in the interests of management, with the support of management, and in the interests of shareholders, and supported by a majority of the shareholders, were to prevail in court, the family would be in the situation where the question would be, well, do they get their super voting rights back? But if the family were to use those super voting rights to then try to change the board in order then to achieve the transfer of the shares and the registration with a deal like they're doing, I think it would circumvent exactly what the courts would have in a lengthy process decided was not legal and in circumvention of the statutes. So it won't happen. So it is a difficult situation because clearly the family has the economic rights and the rights that are afforded to it under the statutes. But I think we will have to see, and I'm hopeful that the economic interest will prevail, which is that the family will prefer to have some kind of an agreed outcome, divesting themselves of their shares, and the company and the board can come up with a solution with the support of shareholders that will resolve the issue and allow Sika to generate the value that we think it will.
Terrific. Well, Chris, we will leave it there. I would just like to encourage everyone listening, if you do have follow-up questions, to reach out either to us or to Chris directly, and I'm sure he'll be happy to address any additional queries. And with that, Chris, thank you so much for being here with us and for sharing your thesis in such detail.